Miguel Farias is an experimental psychologist at Coventry University, where he leads the Brain, Belief, and Behavior Research Group. This is Miguel Farias. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. All right. I'm here with Miguel Farias. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Glad to talk to you, Duncan.
So I had read a book of yours called The Buddha Pill, which the title of it sounds like something, it evokes the phrase the red pill, of course, and it sounds like something a religious person might write. But you're, you know, an experimental psychologist, you're in the sciences. What got you drawn to this subject?
There's a prehistory to it. The history involves doing a randomized control study of meditation and yoga across British prisons. We were then working with a small charity called the Prison Phoenix Trust, who have been organizing yoga and meditation classes for over 20 years across British prisons. So that was really the starting point. It was originally going to be a book focusing on potential radical transformations in these individuals that were in jail. But it then just grew into a much wider book on meditation. The prehistory of it is that I did my doctorate in Oxford in experimental psychology, looking at New Age individuals. It's not very fashionable to talk about New Age spirituality today because so much of it has just become mainstream spirituality. But anyway, this includes a whole range of ideas and practices from meditation to Reiki healing and some ideas such as we are all connected, a huge emphasis on personal change, that you can change yourself radically by undertaking certain spiritual practices such as meditation. So that's really the context of out of which this book grew. The other thing is that my co-author, Catherine Vickel, she wasn't then a clinical psychologist, but she was already training. So there's also this edge clinical psychology angle to it.
And when you talked about the potential radical treatments for these prisoners, what was your working hypothesis and how did that turn out?
So I actually like to work with, what can we call it, the sort of native or indigenous hypothesis. So within New Age spirituality, it would be precisely that you can radically transform yourself if you do certain practices regularly. With the prison sample, it wasn't our working hypothesis, but it was the working hypothesis of this charity, that by undertaking yoga and meditation, some of these prisoners would come to realize that there really is no difference between their individual selves and everyone else and the wider world and universe. And this would lead to an experience of radical transformation. When it came to the psychology of it, we had a much more concise set of hypotheses, but this was the sort of the ideas in the background that nourish this charity. And I mean, those of quite a lot of practitioners, I mean, certainly quite a lot of the prisoners had in their individual letters some ideas that they were expecting through yoga and meditation to come to a place of peace and change that they hadn't experienced before in their lives. Although some of them were like many other people in the world doing mindfulness today, they were just looking for a way of dealing with their anxieties and stress.
Right, and that's, just to frame this right off the bat, you're not anti-meditation or anything like that. You're more a skeptic of the claims and the radical claims that people make that meditation alone is for everybody going to be a super effective treatment for anxiety, depression, et cetera, et cetera. correct?
Yes, that is correct. I never started this book or any other work with the assumption of being antagonistic towards it. Quite the opposite. And I think I'm coming from a wider perspective in some ways. I mean, on the one hand, a scientific one, an empiric, very empirical, experimental one, thinking that, okay, let's have a look at the evidence. And quite a lot of this book actually grew out of the surprise of looking through the evidence and just noticing the gap there was between all the excitement. I mean, an excitement which was familiar to me, having studied New Age spirituality, because that excitement is clearly there. And then it just moved on into the mainstream culture with mindfulness. But I've also studied religious experience across various traditions. And I spent some of the last years studying more, putting a large handbook on meditation for Oxford University Press. And I've studied some more of the religious tradition, the meditation within these religious traditions. So I'm also aware of the wider context of these practices and how there is an analytical engagement with these practices across traditions. So the idea that meditation per se will radically transform you and will only lead to good results is something very, very naive, which is in many ways, I mean, a novelty. Although there has been excitement across various religious traditions, there has always been a more analytical approach to them and looking also at the limitations, drawbacks, and also potential adverse effects.
Well, let's talk about potential adverse effects, because I thought that was interesting, where the idea for a lot of people going into meditation is, I'll give you an example. There was a Zen monk who I had on this podcast, and he was hired for some corporate conference where they brought him in to teach mindfulness. And he was one of several stations that employees would go to throughout the day. And he would do his little spiel. They would practice their mindfulness for 5 minutes. And then, you know, the bell would ring and people would move and go to the next auditorium. And a new crowd would come in. And he was of the opinion that this was really not how meditation should be used, because the company wanted to use it to decrease employee stress and thereby increase productivity. Yeah. But in this weird isolated environment where you're basically, you know, closing your eyes and saying, I want to be less stressed. Come on. Like, is this working yet? It didn't have the proper effect. So what you talk about how some people got more stressed meditating. What's behind that?
That's a really, really interesting example you just gave. I mean, and we know from other practices, or I mean, even taking of certain mind-altering substances, that context plays a large part. Now, after we finished the book, so in the book, we're also surprised to come across this literature on meditation adverse effects going back to the mid-1970s. And there is even a position statement from the American Psychiatric Association calling for kind of open-minded investigation into meditation and its effects, both the benefits and its counterindications, including its dangers. So that's, I mean, literally the statement from the American Psychiatric Association, even including the word dangers. But, I mean, until recently, until a few years ago, there practically wasn't any recent literature on these adverse effects. Just to complement what you've said, a few months ago, I think it was in August, we've published something which was inspired precisely by that chapter, the dark night of meditation in that book, in which we assessed, we did a systematic review of all the literature on this, and it was a headache. And we also looked at the prevalence, how prevalent this was in the literature. And we were surprised, actually, we're surprised to find that the prevalence of these adverse events, and most of it has to do with increases in stress, anxiety, and depression. You also get stronger adverse effects, sort of psychotic acute episodes, but those are rarer. But the overall prevalence of this is between 7 and 8%. And this is very similar to what we know from the wider psychotherapy literature, that you tend to get these adverse effects by going to a psychotherapist, and it's about the same prevalence. Now, why does this happen? There's various reasons. To give a very clear example, sometimes it happens that people have suffered traumas early in life and they forget this, or in psychoanalytical terms, they repress this for very good reasons, just a coping mechanism. And they remember these episodes when doing meditation. So, and by doing this, they sort of reenact the trauma, and this, of course, makes them relive the trauma, and they have anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, that kind of stuff. So that's one instance in which this can happen. One question is whether this only happens to people who have some kind of mental health history. So some people have, some mindfulness researchers, for example, have tried to play that card that no, this meditation, mindfulness can only be positive, and this only happens to people who already have a mental illness disposition or history. We can't tell for sure, because most of the literature neglects to ask people about mental health history. That is one thing. The other thing is that quite a lot of these interventions are actually directed at people who have unusually high levels of stress, anxiety, and depression, as you know. But if we just focus on the case studies literature, there's about 40% of these who did have previous mental health history, but more than half of them had not. And in another paper by Jared Lindahl and his colleagues, some of which at Brighton, they found out something similar. Quite a lot of these people who had somewhat severe adverse effects in the case of his qualitative study had no previous mental health history. So there's something else going on here. Now, the problem has to do also with the kind of model of the mind that we are adopting. So when you're meditating, you're somehow stimulating a modified or altered state of consciousness. And our kind of, particularly our cognitive and somewhat mechanistic models of the mind, aren't very good at mapping out what happens when you enter into altered states of consciousness. But if we want to move into more psychodynamic metaphors of the mind, it may simply be that you're coming into contact with parts of yourself that you were just oblivious of. I mean, and this needn't be even put into terms of specific images or experiences. It may simply be that you're getting in touch with parts of yourself, and somehow this rises, this stimulates anxiety, even panic attacks, or some other kind of episodes. I mean, it's very, very precarious, our knowledge of why this happens. Let me just finish by saying that within the meditation traditions, I mean, there's, for over 1,000 years, there has been mentions of potential adverse effects. And this has to do with you using techniques which don't match your temperament, your psychological makeup, or it may be that you're using them in the wrong way. So those are some of the reasons given.
Well, there's a couple of things I want to touch on there. Going back to the prisoners who did not experience this sudden transformation of self, when we talk about sort of plucking this meditation practice out of the environment it came from, in other words, meditation for let's say a Buddhist practitioner was one part of an entire cosmology, and it was supported by a bunch of different a community that you lived in, let's say other philosophies, so on and so forth. If you take a prisoner out of prison and put them into a monastery for 10 years where all they do is pray and meditate and chant and sing songs and focus on compassion, I think that it would probably, for most people, this is totally unscientific, but it seems like that would have a positive effect for most people, at least on their stress levels, if nothing else. But when, how much of the problem here is that people are relying on this one tool and ignoring the rest of, the philosophy around it, or the other practices, let's say.
Yeah, I mean, you're mentioning something which is really, really important. You're absolutely right. So there's two issues here. One has to do with the whole embeddedness, with the whole context in which this is being practiced. The other has to do with what we can call the cognitive scaffolding, or the cognitive or meaningful framework of the practice. I mean, I think you're right. And the reason why monasticism, why people have left the world and moved into monasteries, is precisely because they found out that personal transformation is really, really hard. And it's best if you just remove yourself from the usual concerns of the world and have other people who share your metaphysical goals all working together. So that would be a wonderful experiment, wouldn't it?
Yes. Get some prisoners
and put them within a monastic context. I mean, we have anecdotal stories, of course, of saintly characters from across all traditions, from Buddhism to Christianity, that were criminals and murderers, and until something of a religious nature changed them, and it put them on a different track. That would be a great experiment. Now, you're also right on the scaffolding. So if there is, and I'm sorry, just to give an anecdote. So while giving popular science talks on meditation, I've had, more than two or three, a bunch of people coming forward and talking to me afterwards that they had done these 10-day Vipassana meditation retreats, which are silent retreats. You have very, very little or no guidance. I mean, you have some recorded talks, and then at the end you talk to a meditation instructor at the end of the retreat. So you're mostly left on your own with no mental or cognitive framework to understand your experiences. And some of these people were atheists, so they didn't believe in anything metaphysical, but they experience various kinds of phenomena which they really, really couldn't make sense of, and they were asking me all sorts of curious questions, trying to make sense of what had happened to them while they were doing these retreats. Now imagine someone doing a meditation retreat, or even doing a usual mindfulness practice, and they have an experience in which their usual sense of self dissolves, right? So for some people, this can be a very joyful, ecstatic experience where suddenly all their concerns disappear. For others, it can be something really, really difficult to assimilate, because they might feel a deep sense of loneliness or even of ego fragmentation. So depending how this experience is framed, it can lead to something either very positive or something potentially drastically negative, simply because you don't have the kind of framework which is embedded in all these spiritual traditions, which may guide whatever you're experiencing.
Well, you know what's interesting about that? I had talked to, for this podcast, I talked to another neuroscientist, Christoph Koch, and he was talking about ego death associated with certain psychedelic experiences where people have a loss of self, or even in extreme experiences of, you know, climbing a tall mountain and you're just totally concentrated on the task because otherwise you drop off the side of the mountain. And you forget the sort of chattering in your brain that meditation also is trying to sort of get you to slip out of. And as you said, that can be a challenging experience. I'm wondering if, similar to, say, a challenging psychedelic experience, that's, I suppose you're right that people should be wary that that could happen and be aware that that could happen. But do you at all feel like that is, that's not really necessarily a knock on meditation, but more of a, I don't know how to put it. I mean, there are people who take psychedelics and get and have challenging experiences and still get something out of it and still say that was a worthwhile thing to do, even though I was terrified for 6 hours. And you see what I'm saying? Like, is it possible that even the challenging meditation experiences could be over the long run beneficial?
Yes and no. I think that would be my straight answer.
Okay.
and this has been a matter of debate for a while. I'm thinking of a paper by someone who used to do meditation on research meditation, Dean Shapiro, from the early 1980s, and where he says precisely that he cannot agree with all his meditation happy friends who claim that ultimately this will be a good experience despite being challenging. Not all psychologically challenging experiences end up being good. This reminds me of the literature on post-traumatic growth. So particularly in the US, there is this mythology around trauma. So for instance, within evangelical Christianity, the more charismatic or Pentecostal type, I've been told that you cannot be a pastor, you cannot be a leader within your church unless you have an experience of trauma or something horrible that happened to you, which you use in your narrative. So I went through this, and that is the reason why I've come here. So the idea that all trauma leads to post-traumatic growth, that's wrong, right? Yeah. The reason why there's so many people, I mean, damage is precisely because they haven't been able to reach the end of the tunnel, right? So yeah. I don't think we can be psychologically naive about that. And the same thing works with psychedelics. I always think of, I think it's one of the latest books by Ray Bradbury, which he dedicates to all his friends. I think, I can't remember exactly whether he says, who were damaged or died by taking too much LSD.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so there's definitely bad trips. And again, we know from the research, and there's some really interesting new research being done both in London and in the US, the use of psychedelics, that context, having been within a safe context, seems to play a major, major role. I wanted to tell you something else, but it escapes my mind now. So you were talking about the psychedelic trip. And yes, I remember now. So something else which I've been thinking about for why these experiences may actually be more common than we think. I mean, the unusual trip, potentially the bad trip. Within the Western set of mind, I think we've become used to dealing with a very controlled world, and this somehow has narrowed our spectrum of consciousness. Let me try not to be too esoteric about this. Just the way that, so imagine how within 200 years we have moved from being much more in a undomesticated world, right? Much closer to a natural environment, to something industrialized where, I mean, what is the major thing we teach our children in terms of survival? Crossing the road, right? Something basic like that, which for most of our evolution, we didn't have to worry about. We had to worry about other kinds of...
Or don't talk to strangers.
Yeah, yes. And when you move to other cultures, I mean, whether Asian or African, so for instance, a common religious experience in Africa, and I had no idea about this until I've heard it from, I mean, various African people, is of shape-shifting. So during the night, for instance, you may be transformed into a tree. So, I mean, for us, this is a psychotic experience.
Right.
But for them, it's perfectly accepted, to the point that some African novelists would say that, I mean, some people refer to what we write as magical. It's not. It's perfectly normal for shape-shifting to occur. I mean, this is a common daily occurrence. We don't look at this as magical. So I think that because we have become constrained in the way we experience everyday life, that any kind of technique which takes us out of our particularly narrow spectrum of consciousness, it's like moving us into deeper waters or high into the ocean, and we're just not used to it. I mean, think that, I mean, lots, I mean, even within a Western religious context, pre-Protestant Reformation, you had all these practices, which surely they must have led to very unusual states of mind, either these processions or fasting periods. I mean, all of these were common. I mean, things like fasting, for example, have completely disappeared mostly from Western Christianity. So all of these things that had profound effects on how we experience the world and ourselves have just changed drastically within the last 200 years.
Well, that's an interesting question. That have they done any sort of meditation trials or experiments in the cultures they were talking about, like in Africa or Asia?
Again, that's a really, really interesting point. So I haven't come across any of these. I mean, there's a few things, but they're almost anecdotal examples. So no, I mean, in the same way that there's very, very few studies contrasting, for instance, mindfulness meditation as adapted and developed in the West with other kinds of religious-based techniques, there's very, very few things in that way, contrasting a religious-based contemplative technique with an adapted Western one. So that's great. I mean, just to give another example, I have a project on religious possession, which again, it's omnipresent across cultures, but we look at it with a very distant mind. It just seems very, very exotic that people get into these trance states and they claim to be possessed by different entities, whether in nature spirits or within Muslim context, a jinn, which is a kind of a mischievous demon, up to, I mean, there's channeling, which is on the softer side, but I mean, within sort of Afro-Brazilian religions, for example, it's again very, very common for these religious possessions to occur, and people go there to receive all kinds of healing and counseling. But we don't really know how to deal with this. if you look at the psychiatric manual of diagnosis, the DSM, they say that, well, if this is happening within a religious, a cultural context where possession is accepted, then you can't really say that it is a pathology. But I mean, just to give the example of Brazil, most of it is Catholic, right?
Right.
So there's a huge prejudice regarding the phenomenon, although quite a lot of Catholics, when they need healing or some kind of spiritual counseling, they would go there. But we don't really know what's happening. So we do not have, going back to that idea, we don't have the psychological models of the mind that allows us to understand exactly what is going on, other than thinking of a dissociation context, which we know from a pathological context, but not really from a healthy one.
Right. So that's my question then is, so when people talk about shape shifting or extra being, you know, possessed by a demon, I assume you don't actually think that someone in the middle of the night transforms into a tree and then, you know, pops back into being human. Do you have any idea of, do you have any guesses about what might be happening?
If you ask me as an experimental psychologist.
Or as a person, whatever.
No, not really. But, I mean, this has been going on for a very, very long time. The idea of shape-shifting within human cultures. And just to give an example of a beautiful little piece of cognitive archaeology, I think we can call it that, Emmanuel Honoré, a French archaeologist, was studying one of these rock art painting murals in Africa, where you have lots of hands painted in the rock, and then you have smaller hands within these large hands. And the early archaeologists who looked at this was only found around 2000, wrote a few papers saying that, oh, how nice, the adults have put their hands there, and then they put the hands of their little children within their own hands. And she looked at the hands, took measures, went back to France, looked at the anatomy of the hands of recent born children, and realized that these cannot be hands. These are not human hands at all. So she looked at the kind of animals that were present in this place, and she found out that these were the hands of a kind of lizard. And this just shows our kind of prejudice. So we're looking at this from our 21st century perspective. Oh, the parents put their children's hands. What was actually happening was that the way these people looked at the world was very, very different from our own. So these lizards had particular properties which they were trying to enact or assimilate magically. That's much more likely to be the case. So we've been trying to acquire animal characteristics for various reasons, either because they have particular strength or particular qualities that we're trying to assimilate, which is why within quite a lot of shamanic cultures, you get this idea that you enter into a trance state, either through dancing or sometimes taking psychedelic substances, and you're not just able to move into a particular spiritual realm, but quite often you are shape-shifted into this animal. So you acquire these characteristics because you benefit from this. You see the world from a completely different perspective. I'm not sure if you're acquainted with Stan Grof, which we mentioned in the book. Stan Grof started doing research with LSD and then treating them, particularly psychotic schizophrenic patients with LSD. And then when this is forbidden, he develops this method of inducing very, very altered states of mind, I mean, which mimic psychedelics, but just by using breath work and music. And he learned this from various shamans. And one of the experiences, so I once met him and was at a workshop with him, and some of the experiences people had was exactly of that. They experienced, for instance, being an animal, a wolf, and their whole perception of the world was described from the standpoint of that creature. So this has been happening for a very, very long time. I mean, some of my our scientist colleagues might try to explain this in somewhat woo-woo terms. It's as if, somehow we have the genetic memory of what it might have been like to be that kind of animal. We can come up with some fanciful woo explanation, but we really, really have no way of engaging with this. I might as well say that from a Jungian point of view of a collective unconscious, it is somehow within us, the experience of what a fish might experience the world like. We don't know.
Have you, on that similar note about breath work, have you looked at some of the more extreme claims about meditation, particularly with figures like Wim Hof, who has actually been tested and hooked up to machines and has demonstrated that he can control his temperature and his heartbeat, apparently at will and purely by sheer concentration? He claims this is because of his particular form of breath work and the fact that he takes cold showers and that he meditates. Have you looked into that at all, or does it give you any thoughts to consider?
Yeah, I have looked at it years ago because I was doing some work on pain and religion. And there's some really, really interesting cases. I mean, these are mostly case studies that you get going back to the 1980s. So there's this whole exotic idea that some ascetic individuals, so again, I mean, people who undergo very unusual practices, so they either fast for long times or meditate for long times or do other kinds of, think back to the Desert Fathers, some of which were living on top of pillars for years. I never quite understood how that was done. I mean, certainly someone brought them food. But some of these individuals have unusual characteristics. So they either can change their heart rate at will or even body temperature. And there's a Tibetan meditation technique. I forget the name now, but it's supposed to do that. And there's at least a couple of studies showing that it is possible, that it does work. But for the most part, they're exceptional cases. So I'm thinking back of, they were called fakirs, particularly in the Indian tradition. So do you remember these photographs of people lying on top of nail beds?
Right.
Yeah. So in India, they did this to earn money. Right, so it was a performance act, but there was someone in Germany in the 1980s who brought over into the lab one of these people who, and they did lots of experiments on them, so they could indeed withstand all sorts of piercing without feeling it. They would just get into this trance-like state, and there's still some interesting rituals. Thai Pusan, originally from South India, very popular in Malaysia, where people pierce themselves. So they train themselves to go into a trance state. Some of them have only basic kinds of piercing of tongue, lips, but some are pierced and it takes 2 or 3 hours and then they carry these really heavy religious artifacts. But those are the exceptional cases. So it does happen that some people have the ability to go into particularly deep trance states and they don't feel this kind of pain. The German researcher, however, found that with this religious expert, Fakir, that although he was able to not feel quite a lot of pain, he found out that if he pressed the sole of his feet in a certain way, he would feel the pain. But they're extraordinary cases. Most people, can't really achieve that kind of very, very altered state of mind. I mean, at least without lots of efforts. But I think there is the case. I mean, it's like gifted marathon runners, that some people are just naturally gifted to get into particularly altered states of mind.
So in other words, you think that Wim Hof maybe people following his practices will not get the same results that he's particularly gifted.
I think so, but this is not to say that, I mean, if you practice something regularly, how you may, I mean, get some results. We don't know much about individual differences within this field, but I would bet that some individuals are just more gifted to enter into particular states of mind. I mean, like, some individuals are more susceptible to being hypnotized or to get into a particular state of absorption.
Right. Well, on that same note, then, how much, when you talk about individual differences and people being more susceptible or people being better at it, in some ways, if we look at these meditation or, you know, Wim Hof breathing as a form of treatment, and certain people taking to the treatment better than others, isn't it the case that even, you know, antidepressant drugs like SSRIs also have wildly different levels of effectiveness as well? I mean, there are all kinds of people who go through 4 different drugs and then discover the one that works for them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you look at meditation at this point as a viable form of treatment for any mental illness?
I think meditation can be used within a therapeutic context. I mean, as an adjunct, I mean, I think that all these mindfulness-based techniques that are being used, it's not meditation per se, it's a whole package, right? And there's some studies, dismantling trials, trying to tease out how much is due to the meditation component, how much is it due to what they sometimes call the psychoeducational component. So I do think that it can be used with success for some conditions. I mean, people like Mark Williams, who came up with the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for people who have experienced at least 3 episodes of depression. I mean, it seems to be moderately successful, as successful as other forms of therapy. I certainly would not think that meditation per se, or even packages, would work, I mean, for all kinds of mental health problems. No, I wouldn't think so. And again, this varies. I think this would vary considerably from person to person.
I want to wrap up here, but before we go, for people who are already meditating and who are listening to this and say, oh my gosh, are you saying that this, am I, you know, taking the wrong road here? Am I wasting my time? If they feel as though they're getting a good experience out of this, what would your advice be to them?
Oh, if they're getting a good experience, I really think that for the majority of people who feel that this is working for them, it's no different from a physical relaxation technique. And when you go back in the literature, I mean, to the 1920s, 1930s, there really is no difference. Actually, up to the 1960s, probably, there really is no difference in whether we call this meditation or relaxation. It's just the way we've come to address it. But it's what's doing for most people whom are feeling that this is relaxing them. It's either doing meditation or a physical relaxation technique. It's identical. So in that sense, I mean, I don't have anything to say against it for those people who are feeling that they're getting more relaxed or less stressed from doing meditation 20 minutes per day.
And what about for people who are thinking about trying it?
I don't have anything against people trying meditation. I would just caution them that this is not something that is pleasant or it works for everyone, and for them to be aware of that.
Well, I think that's a good way to end it then. Miguel, is there anything you want to plug or get out there before we go?
No, just to finish on that note, I remember once talking to someone who did a lot of work on consciousness in the 1970s and 80s, Charles Sturt, who told me that, so because he was living in California and all of his friends were doing meditation, that he meditated daily for 10 years until he realized that it wasn't doing anything at all. He was just doing it because of the social pressure of all his friends. So don't feel that you have to submit to the social pressure just because the media or your friends are telling you that you should do it and it will be good for you.
Well, there you go. Miguel, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Duncan. It was a pleasure.
My pleasure. All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you to Miguel Farias, and thanks for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.